Welcome to the Reaction Podcast hosted by me, Ian Martin. I'm joined today by my colleague Maggie Pagano, Executive Editor of Reaction. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction and you want to get my weekly newsletter, you want to get Maggie's column every week and all the other great writing from the team, including Tim Marshall on geopolitics, Adam Bolton, all sorts of other fantastic writers, then you go to the website www.reaction.life and you sign up either monthly or you can take an annual subscription, which is best value. This is a podcast where we discuss politics, geopolitics, business, economics, culture, whatever we like, really, and there is a lot to discuss. Maggie, I'm going to dive straight in on the question of the Remembrance weekend and the situation with Suella Braverman, UK Home Secretary. Now, we're recording this on Thursday afternoon and the situation is rather fast moving, so you may know by the time you listen to this what the outcome has been. Maybe nothing has changed by then, but we'll see. How do you read it? Firstly, on the Suella Braverman position, she authored this piece for The Times, which there was some confusion about whether or not Number 10 had known. It now seems at the time of recording that they didn't know. What the hell does Sunak do about it?
Oh, goodness. What I read, true or not, is that Number 10 did read it, suggested some changes, but those changes weren't put through, so they can't quite say it was signed off. What I feel is that whilst I agree with, there are an awful lot of points that Suella Braverman makes, which I don't think are hard to disagree with, I'm not sure that her language has been very clever. We have a policy of this country having demonstrations. We have strict laws on that. I think that perhaps her description of them as hate marches and Palestinian mobs was subjective. And unnecessary, actually, whatever you feel about it. You know, in a sense, isn't it that if you think they are dangerous, then you pull the right legislative levers to ban them? And if earlier on, either she or Mark Rowley had stood up and said, it is Remembrance Day, or indeed the Prime Minister, we know that these marches are going on, it was planned for this weekend, but we're not stopping the march, but we really would like it if you suspended it for this week, allow the cenotaph to procession to take place, and then march next week, rather than sort of building it up, allowing the loony Tommy Robinson, whatever, and, you know, where I do agree with her, just very quickly, was where...
So just to explain, Tommy Robinson is the far-right campaigner. Seems to have re-emerged, in, as always happens in these stories, in a kind of Tom Wolfe Bonfire of the Vanities way, when you get this kind of crazy atmosphere, it then attracts other elements and factions.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think there have been two standards. I thought the most interesting point in her article was that, you know, the COVID lockdown sceptics, you know, they were not encouraged, those marches, whereas BLM and policemen dressed up in colours and whatever seem to be encouraged. That's certainly been, I think, the perception that most people have taken from it. But as I said, I don't think it was perhaps very appropriate for her to describe the marches in the way that they have been. Because, it, you know, they are a broad church and you've got some Hamas supporters. The other thing that I think is really interesting, and I did think about 3 weeks ago, there's clearly a lot of organisation going on from all sorts of sources, whether they're Russian sleepers, Iranian sleepers, Hamas sleepers, that has provoked this. I don't believe you get 100,000 people out on the streets because of this. I really don't.
So those organising the marches, of course, deny that. But there have been reports already in certain newspapers about the about influence operations and on the marches about the operations in the West, in countries like the UK, Sweden,
Berlin,
Paris, right. Berlin, the operations of Iranian agents and proxies. It's obviously in their interest to create discontent. The vast number of those on the marches will, of course, be unaware of that or not involved in that. There's a lot to say. I find it incredible that the organisers can think that it's a good idea to have these marches on this particular weekend. Now, of course, the march in London is not going near the Cenotaph. It has an alternative route. It goes down, I think, towards, from Hyde Park, down towards the American Embassy in Vauxhall. So it's not going directly to the Cenotaph. But just the potential for trouble that's created. Also, it seems to be happening, it seems to be no recognition that this is a weekend that there isn't much any longer that the British hold. Now, sacred is maybe a slightly pompous word, but there isn't much that the British hold to be almost sacred. The NHS is certainly, we can, that's a topic for another time, is certainly incredibly popular in the UK. In terms of institutions which bind and events and occasions, Remembrance Sunday, Remembrance Weekend, in this case, because Armistice Day falls on the 11th on the Saturday as well, is about as close as you can get to that kind of event. Very important to the vast majority of people in this country. So why not, if you want, if the point of the marches is not to cause trouble, the point of the marches is to make the political case, to draw attention to it, why not just recognise that this is a weekend where you can just park it, and there have already been three marches, and then resume, if it is legal and they get the approval for it, the following week. I think it's very revealing that they haven't that they haven't, in the interests of social cohesion, which we hear so much about, just haven't decided to just stand aside. They're absolutely determined to have this march. And this is a march. Now, I can see the argument on right to march, freedom to protest, freedom of speech. I get all of that, but it's those rights are not absolute, and there is a social cohesion component which the French deal with by really just not allowing these marches. In Nice again this weekend, the requests for marches have been turned down on the basis that this is a risk to public order.
Other cities as well in France.
And the French have quite a clear idea about this, and no one would say that the French are anti the right to protest. It's almost a national
sport
or preoccupation. They certainly take it very, very seriously. But on this, because of the geopolitical context, the genuine fear really is terrifying. What's happening, the genuine fear among Jewish Britons, the Jewish community in Britain, their concern about safety, about how they are being made to feel in their own city and in their own country, should surely give pause to those who are organising the demonstrations and say that it is within, you know, that they that it's an has an entirely peaceful purpose.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely on that. They would have taken the moral high ground. They would have shown that actually they respect the fact that they have the right to march. You know, that's why they're living here in Britain rather than in their own countries, which are in the main, you know, where they don't allow the free. It would have just been a very clever thing. And what's upsetting is that some of the leaders of those groups, and even First Minister of Scotland, who has some sort of, I guess, some sway over these things, leading figures could have said, out of respect for this very important occasion, you should just hold off.
It's
pathetic, actually.
It's the weekend when this country commemorates its war dead and says thank you for people's service. But I also find it, you know, just the prospect of these marches with those chants, which are, I've heard explanations for the river, from the river to the sea. A campaigner said to me, "Well, it just happens to rhyme." Elementary terms, it is a genocidal chant. We know what it advocates, and it's there on the street.
I don't think it rhymes in Arabic anyway.
Well.
Which is probably the original.
Possibly not. But do you think that Braverman will have to go? She may be gone by the time this podcast airs. But do you think her position is untenable?
Well, it's an interesting question. It seems to me that Sunak has agreed with her on a lot of this, and his comments yesterday. I mean, he clearly wanted. Well, it seemed to be that he wanted the. Sir Mark Rowley to ban or stop the protest, didn't he? And the fact that, you know, the fact that he allowed that number 10 allowed the article, they clearly did see it through. If they only wanted a few edits, it's
well,
sort
there
of
is
mean.
Some confusion about that.
Is there?
Because,
okay.
Yeah, there,
well,
there, there
okay.
is. There's he said, she said, what? About whether it was. I mean, there may also be some cock up involved in terms of it not the process not having been
okay.
followed.
Proper,
we don't know.
Properly vetted. Okay. I mean, can I answer your question with another question? Mm. Does she want to be sacked? You know, if she is pushing, because she's been pushing at this door now for 3 weeks, she knows how it is inflaming opinion. Even though a lot of it, probably half the country do, more than that, agree with a lot of her sentiments, it is perhaps not in her part of her role to say those things. But she, if she were sacked, she puts herself up, doesn't she, as the proper one of the leading contenders to Sunak when and if he loses the next election. Does he sack her? Does he have to sack her? I don't know. Really.
But she becomes then, in the words of Nadine Dorris, who we might mention later on, who has a new book out, for those of you who've missed it, she becomes a martyr for the right, potentially, doesn't she? She's the, and then the leading candidate, or the candidate of the right in any subsequent Tory leadership election, if the Tories lose, and latest poll has them, I think, 24 points behind, so it's looking very tough for them to turn around. And I'm not convinced by that. I'm not convinced that she's the front runner for even a leading contender. I know that sounds that's an odd position at the moment, but I think if you look at the other contenders, it's going to be quite a crowded field. There is, and sometimes the Tory right in these contests isn't as strong in numbers as it thinks it is. And also, we don't know what the shape of the Conservative Party will be if it goes down to defeat at the next election. Who will actually be left in Parliament? How big will the right be? I would say that it's looking at the popularity of polling on Conservative Home, which some people deride, but I think is usually a pretty good test of what the activist conversation. I would say the other runners who are more likely, obviously Kemi Badenoch, and James Cleverly. I think James Cleverly, I would not write off at all as the compromise reasonable candidate, with potentially Kemi Badenoch and Suella Braverman almost fighting each other to a standstill potentially in a leadership contest.
I don't think Braverman, with the membership, she's too much like Marmite. I'm not saying they'd want somebody who's conciliatory, but I think what people would be looking for was somebody of substance and strength and authority and some sort of moral leadership, actually. That's what's been lacking. And I think Cleverly, actually, his coming up on the inside there has shown to be rather, you know, friendly as well and quite warm, but strong character. Whereas Braverman, and create too much friction.
A problem.
The Tory party doesn't need that now. If you want to do that, you have Farage. Do it properly. I really want to see PR in this country now. Yes, I know. I've never been convinced. I think we have to. It's the only answer. Because all these parties, just broad coalitions, let's see them properly. I mean, look.
So you break the Tory party down into its constituent parts, and then arguably the
Labour
party as
too.
Well.
Yeah, and the Corbynites can be proper. Let's see them. Norway, Sweden, they all manage it quite well, and actually it's relatively stable government.
Yeah.
And people use Italy as the example usually, but actually the Nordics are all, you know, very splintered.
I'm very, 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 very strongly opposed to,
well,
to
I have
PR
been
or to changing
Ian,
the
actually.
Voting system. I know, yeah, I'm because I'm surprised to hear that you've shifted.
Yeah, I'm surprised at myself.
But I understand why, because you say, as you say, politics is throwing up all these alternative forces and parties which are not represented. I would say that in defence of the two-party system, we have just had, since 2015 and since the Brexit referendum the following year, we've just had a case study, a perfect example of how and why the two-party system, though it's more than that, of course, because you've got the SNP and then you've got the Liberals as well, but it's two big parties, and why this works and why they're almost like shock absorbers that soak up a lot of the political pressure and mould, and out of it you get a not always, but you're more likely not to get a stable-ish government. And we had a situation where we had a de facto communist, Jeremy Corbyn, as Labour's candidate last time, or as Labour's leader, and would have become Prime Minister, up against Boris Johnson, formidable campaigner, but clearly a flawed character as a Prime Minister. That was the choice, really, for Prime Minister last time. Now, having a two-party system means that the parties reset exceptionally quickly. In the case of Labour, it went for Starmer and has then moved to the centre and is almost unrecognisable as a party because it realised it needed to win over the centre ground. It needed to be more than just a cult following on the far left. It needed to build out and build a coalition. Now, it hasn't really worked for the Conservative Party, but they do have Rishi Sunak, who is technocratic, capable, moderate. No matter what some may think of how the government's doing at the moment, he is a middle ground figure. And you go from Corbyn versus Johnson, that choice, to Starmer versus Sunak, and the system has course corrected. You end up with two sort of relatively moderate figures again. If you have PR, you would have all the noise of the Tory right, a Farageist party, and then my ultimate concern about it is that you end up with a government that no one voted for. You end up with a government that is patched together. Always my objections to PR is patched together, not openly in the formation of a coalition by the parties, but in back rooms afterwards, where they trade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I'm arguing against it myself now. In a sense, what we have seen through the Tory government and what five different leaders since Cameron May, in a sense, we've seen a momentum of a coalition, five different sort of sects, groups that have emerged. So they've been fighting with themselves, which is why they are broad coalitions. Yeah, I just feel that it would be quite good to have more honest, Boris Johnson, his net zero, both May and Johnson's net zero policies, where did they come from? These were not put in any manifesto. These were not debated, and they should have been, and they should have been challenged. We haven't seen challenges on big issues, and I don't know why. I don't know what sort of system would allow that proper challenge to come through.
That's a flaw in the two-party system, isn't it? That it does, once the party leaders have built that big coalition, they then have a lot of power to dictate national policy. And, in the case of net zero, well, one of our listeners is bound to email in and say that it's in the 2015, 2017, 2019. There've been so many manifestos, but that it became almost as a cross-party consensus run, and the two big parties have essentially imposed that policy. I see what you mean. Speaking of net zero, shall we move on to the economy and sort of general state of things? There's the autumn statement coming up on November the 22nd, which is a very big moment for Jeremy Hunt and for the country. And how you were encouraging him to be brave this week, Maggie, in your column for Reaction. You'd like to see him cut some taxes. There's a bit of a clamour from Tory backbenchers who are getting worried about losing their seats. I'm not convinced actually that much would change that, really. The sort of rabbit out the hat, I'm not sure it would. It's going to add, what the Tories need, which is 10 points added to their poll rating at least.
You'd need a 10p cut across the board to do that. I don't think we're going to see that. No, but I think he can sort of not fiddle. I just think I might be wrong about this, but really in the last few weeks, talking to a lot of industrialists, people on the ground, as I said in my column, architects, property developers, builders, I spoke to a couple of CEOs of startups, and they just say they're sort of in a state of paralysis. Mm. Nobody wants to do anything. Maybe that's a sort of pre-Christmas thing as well. We're waiting for interest rates. Loads more people are going to come off their fixed rates. So it's a sort of nervous time. And these things are all about perception, aren't they? Political perception. And we know the state is too heavy. We know that the tax system is ridiculously overloaded. So I suppose what I'm talking about is just, you know, just do a few quite brave things. You don't have to abolish inheritance tax. You could put the level up, which will reflect house prices over the last 20 years. They have frozen thresholds for 6 years, isn't it? 21 to 28.
Which is an enormous stealth
it's
tax.
It's so huge. And as Doug McWilliams, Professor Doug McWilliams, has quantified it, you know, it's like 9p in the pound. Maybe they can unfreeze it. But it is sort of show, not tell.
Yeah.
Inflation may well have halved. May well be down to 5%. I don't know when Octobers are out. Should be soon. It's in the right direction. Unless, of course, we have to caveat, Middle East blows up. But at the moment, oil prices have not reacted to. And the bond markets do appear to have calmed down.
Things seem to have calmed down in the last few weeks.
They do seem to have calmed down. Calm before the storm. Mm. So I'm not saying you should at the edge of it, but some real things. And actually, I noticed after I'd written the piece, the Telegraph had a story this morning saying that he is looking at savings.
Yeah.
Doing something on savings. So, you know, his big push is let's get the capital markets going again. Let's use pensions. Let's use savings, which are virtually at zero, by the way, post-COVID. Mm. That $200 billion has sort of gone. And I use the example in my piece about equity. You know, retail share, and I hadn't realised, it's down to just over 10% now.
Yeah.
Halved. And the Swedes have been really clever about this. They've got a flat rate tax, and it's gone in the same period that we've halved. They've doubled to over 22%. And it's really simple. It's just a tax across the board on all assets. Why don't we do something simple like that? There is an old saying in the North, what Sweden does today, the world does tomorrow.
Yeah.
And think ABBA, IKEA, you know.
Absolutely. All sorts of interesting
meatballs.
Things.
Yes. But that's the sort of thing I'm trying to say. You know, just some quite simple things rather than, I don't know, fiddling back room that nobody takes any notice of.
So there was I can see the bind that he's in because he's got limited room for manoeuvre. Some economists, people like Patrick Minford, say he's got more room for manoeuvre than is commonly accepted, and should be a bit bolder on taxes. There was an interesting report out from the National Institute for Economic and Social Research this week, which said something quite different, which caught my eye. Mm-hmm. Like you, Maggie, I'm an instinctive low tax person. If taxes should be sort of lower and simpler, not necessarily an advocate of a flat tax, but certainly lower and simpler. And we have an enormous tax burden in this country. And you're absolutely right. You can just feel that things are grinding to a halt. Like you, I don't know whether that's just the approach of Christmas. It's been, it's been a busy year, and maybe, but in all sorts of areas like the housing market, business investment, just all sorts of areas, you can feel people just waiting waiting to feel whether
they
have rates sort of topped out and do they start to come down. Because if the money supply figures, economists who know much more about these things than I do, veer between saying that's an intimation of complete disaster, massive recession coming, so this is, you know, money supply
has contracted hugely,
or is it just a reflection of inflation's coming out the system and we'll avoid some terrible recession in the UK, I'm talking about. Also waiting to see what the hell happens with the US, where the US is still relatively robust, actually. You wouldn't think it from the political situation, but so there's all of that to be resolved, so people are watching and waiting. But the National Institute for Economic and Social Research, what interested me about their pitch was that it was all not about personal taxation, which they say there's, you know, very little room for, that all effort and any spare firepower that he has should be used on business investment. And I think
on corporation tax or improving
on extending the reliefs and the set of reliefs that he introduced on expensing and investment. The idea being, look, if you want to get growth,
productivity,
you need productivity to start moving. Britain has had a business investment problem, started to get better. Some real signs earlier this year that the measures that Hunt introduced are working.
Yeah.
So the argument is that they're saying if you have any spare capacity, use it to try and make those changes permanent, to indicate to business, look, this is you going forward. This is the investment environment you can rely on, and then you probably build a consensus also with Labour would approve of that. Mm. But that is a much less, and I can hear free market friends of mine and low tax friends of mine listening to this podcast saying, don't be so ridiculous, don't be so wet. That's them just calling for an extension of public investment effectively and then hoping that the private sector will borrow. Actually go to the core of it and cut on personal taxation and put
and corporation tax, the dividend tax, which of course they put up.
Yeah. So
why would you want to run a small company these days? I mean, the tax is
So put money back in people's pockets personally and in in corporates directly, and then trust them to invest. I can see the arguments both ways. It does indicate really that Hunt and the government are in a really difficult situation coming up to the November autumn statement, in that there'll be a lot of political clamour from desperate Tory backbenchers for something they can shout about on the doorsteps. 1p off this, 2p off that. I think they're probably going to be disappointed, actually. I think he'll have to balance that business investment question with sufficient measures on, as you said, saving and try and do something on allowances and somehow
enterprise
then try
and, allowances, which we talked about in the last time. I absolutely agree, because of course all that, and you don't necessarily, you're not able to explain that in, it won't make the front page the Daily Mail the next day after the autumn statement. But if businesses have the incentive, of course, then that leads to more investment, hopefully more jobs, and improving productivity.
Yeah.
So he's to do a combination.
Yeah, he somehow has to balance all of that. Good luck. Good luck.
Yeah.
Question about Labour, and we talked about Braverman at the beginning, just about how Labour are positioned, and there's now we're less than a year away from the likely date of the general election, if we assume that he's not going to go to January 2025, which he can. So the election will, my working assumption is next autumn. It could be earlier, but I think it's unlikely.
So how long a lead time before you have to call an election? I mean, how long do you have to announce it?
I mean, it depends how long you want, whether you want a short campaign or a short campaign. Well,
can you wait a month? Can you wait till September next year?
I can't remember the minimum number of days, but some prime ministers, particularly when things are looking sticky, like John Major in 1997, choose a very long campaign.
Yeah.
So you could have a campaign running for effectively sort of six and a bit weeks, or you can go shorter than that. Can't remember the minimum minimum dates, but my assumption is next autumn. Labour are 20 odd points ahead. They're looking like the government in waiting. That's the way in which they're talked about in Westminster. That's the assumption. Do you think there's any way the Tories can turn it around? I don't mean specific policies, but is it plausible that the economy does a bit better in the spring? And
it could do, and I wanted to mention when we were talking about the economy earlier, Hugh Pill, the chief economist at the Bank of England, slightly contradicted his governor in a speech yesterday, where he said probably it could well be that we've topped out and that there will be a danger if we keep up restrictive monetary policy, suggesting that maybe 5.25 or even cuts. So, you know, that sort of shows a sign of confidence. I'm going to answer that by saying events, my boy. What was interesting is since the Hamas attack on Israel and Labour's obviously very tricky, delicate, sensitive position between the two communities, all the polling has barely changed, has it?
It's made no difference at all.
It was 0.3 up, I think I saw, despite a few resignations and more threats. So clearly, sort of, you know, people have appreciated the fine line that he was walking. It's just, can the Tories...
It's difficult to see how.
I wouldn't put just money.
On Labour...
Let's talk about Trump coming back. That's probably a more likely.
Cheery subject, yeah. just on Labour, I don't... Yeah. It's not clearly not doing Starmer harm, in that he is, as you said, the poll lead is still, he's still got this great stonking poll lead, and I think such is the atmosphere in the country, and the Tories have hit that terrible part of the cycle where people just want change and just want them off the television, and it's very, very difficult for Sunak to argue against that or to beat that. But I think it's clearly the Hamas, the Palestinian situation, the crisis in the Middle East is not doing Starmer any harm. It may actually be doing him some good in one respect, in that he has taken a robust position, actually. I do think Sunak should acknowledge that. And it comes at some political cost in that there are resignations, but actually it's probably helping him in that he's probably losing some... people on the left, it suits him for them to not be around. If they resign from the Labour Party, then great. Certain councillors from certain council groups that have resigned this week. Longer term,
others come forward that would not have done because of
that's true. Yeah. Longer term, there might be a possibility of, I don't think it would make a difference in this general election, but you may see the emergence of some other kind of left party of the left or pro-Palestine party. We know from what happened with UKIP and the Brexit Party, you don't need to win seats in Westminster to cause disruption to one of the two large parties. So that's clearly not going to happen now, or probably not this side of the election, but there's just the possibility there of a grouping in Parliament emerging, and maybe a group of councillors, or don't know, distant possibility. But it certainly looks as though Labour are miles ahead and looking like the government.
Can I ask you something, Ian?
Shoot.
Off-piste, but I have to say, this year is the first time I've walked into a supermarket and loved seeing all the Christmas things on the shelves. Usually I moan and go, oh, why don't they wait till December the 1st?
Yeah.
But I think this year has been so miserable. Actually, it was a great sight. But this brings me to the M&S ad, where basically Christmas is sort of gone, hasn't it? And now I haven't seen it, but the John Lewis one, there's a Venus flytrap rather than a Christmas tree or something. Is it the CEOs who've become social activists? Are we ashamed of having Christmas? Are they trying to appeal across the board to people of different religions? But, a lot of the non-Christians I know, or even Brits who are atheists, love Christmas, and many people celebrate it. Do you think they're shooting themselves in the foot with this?
It's a good question. Often overlooked in the rise of Donald Trump, an important factor was it just seemed like a fringe subject at the time, the way he used to go on. I mean, before he was president and even before he was running, it was a pet subject of his, was that they're cancelling holidays and, they won't have the Christmas tree in such and such department store, and you can't even say the word holidays, or you can't even say Christmas holidays. And it's played out during his presidency as well. But it is a bit of a... conservative sort of populist button, sort of hot button. So it's never really bothered me. I've always kind of taken the view that the supermarkets and the big department stores, they do their focus groups and they do their polling on this. I've always suspected, if anyone from one of those department stores wants to get in touch and tell me we're wrong, I've always suspected that younger consumers are just less into all of the sort of Christmas stuff. I don't, but maybe younger listeners will tell me I'm completely wrong. But there is obviously this, I hesitate to use the W word, but there is this pressure to make it about holidays and not about Christmas. Maybe that's what they're getting
at. Such a paradox, because even most Brits, 30%, 20% now call themselves religious. Yeah. So we all go along with the fantasy, and we don't even pretend, most of us, that Christmas, you know, is just a great, wonderful festival based on Saturnalia or, you know, the winter season. So why do we need to sort of change that? It is a fantasy anyway, so let's just keep it as this wonderful fantasy holiday.
Yeah. But it's increasingly a kind of drinking festival.
Since Roman times, I'm sure. I don't think that's changed.
Well, maybe it's,
you know, midwinter, you want to celebrate. Yeah. You haven't been to Norway, where the copious amounts of aquavit, I mean, is made. Yeah. You know, so maybe they're just being commercial, is what you're saying. And they're just...
Possibly. So, I mean, the advert you're talking about was a bit of a non-story, wasn't it?
In
that it became a row about were the Palestinian colours being burnt, but I think it was a sort of Christmas cracker being burnt that just happened to be the same colours.
Yeah, it wasn't even that actually, but the rest of it is people hitting Father Christmas and sort of banishing the Christmas things, which seemed really weirder than the sort of flag issue. Anyway,
I'm just going to sound really, really old and grumpy in that. Yeah, I hate one thing I do hate is the way in which the emergence of these adverts has become a story in itself, which it wasn't really the case 20 years ago. It was John Lewis who started it, and it's a very clever piece of marketing.
That's brilliant.
And it now starts in the argument about Christmas ads and whether or not they mention Christmas and whether the ads are any good. It seems to start now in October and then really pick up in November. I'm just...
Just keeps the plebs happy, I suppose. Really, the newspapers happy.
Really old-fashioned. I would just like to just go back to not really thinking about Christmas until about...
The
15th of December, and then having a sort of Christmas piss up, an office party, and all that sort of stuff, and seeing friends, and then finishing on the 21st, 22nd, and then seeing family, having a great time. So thinking about Christmas for about 10 days rather than now, which seems to be 3 months.
Yeah.
But that's maybe that's just me.
Maybe that's what they wanted to achieve.
Yeah.
Get us all talking.
Exactly. We didn't talk about Trump, but we'll talk about... There are going to be lots of opportunities to talk about him, and probably at the moment, he's the name to get people to sort of turn off. So, I mean, you know, we'll think of our listeners and talk about Trump another time.
And who might replace Biden? I mean...
Yeah.
Is that at all possible, do you think?
At the moment, I mean, looking... Well, two things have happened in the week that we're recording this. There were a set of terrible opinion polls for the Democrats, or for Biden, which appeared over the weekend, showing Trump ahead in a Trump versus Biden runoff, which really spooked the Democrats. Mm. And you start to see people like David Axelrod, who was Obama's strategist, emerging saying, respectfully, Mr. President, it's time to rethink. So there was this clamour over the weekend, and then a series of off-year contests in various American states in which the Democrats did surprisingly well, or against counter to expectations, to which Biden said, see, polls don't vote, polls don't count, these are real votes, and the Democrats can win. But as some of his critics pointed out, he wasn't on the ballot on this week. When people voted in certain states in America, which is a fair point. So I don't think that better than expected performance will kill off the speculation about Biden, because there's clearly a problem in terms of his age and vitality and mental acuity. There is a problem that's been identified. On the Republican side, the debate was this week, and the also-rans just, you know, ran themselves to a standstill, fought themselves to a standstill, and he is miles out in front as the front runner. Would be very, very surprising if Donald Trump is not the nominee. Mm. Someone else would have to emerge. Now we're in for it's now less than a year to go.
Yeah.
It was a year on Tuesday.
Yeah.
So a year from now, we'll be recording a podcast on President Biden, President Trump to come, or it could be, I mean, American politics, it's possible a third party candidate emerges, not a third party candidate who could necessarily win, but a third party candidate that, on the model of Ross Perot in 1992, garners enough votes to sway the result one way or another. So that's a possibility. Or you could even see an old-fashioned brokered convention at either of the conventions if the parties effectively didn't want the candidate, then you could have a Democrat convention, which is taking place in Chicago, which is, of course, resonant historically. It's where the Democrats had that great disastrous convention in 1968. Well, they're back in Chicago this time. So is it... It's not completely implausible that if Biden couldn't stand, you end up then post-primaries having to have some form of brokered convention or some sort of compromise candidate, with it being fought out on the convention floor. All of that is feasible. Or Biden just sort of Biden just carries on, doesn't suffer some sort of health emergency and is the candidate. And they're both older candidates, so ill health could intervene. So it's going to be an exciting year.
Be very fascinating.
On that cheery note, let's wrap up for this week. Maggie Pagano, executive editor of Reaction, thank you very much for joining me. You've been listening to the Reaction podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, go to the website www.reaction.life. You get Maggie's weekly column, you get my weekly newsletter, and lots more writing from the team, and also a daily briefing on the stories that matter. Until next time, thank you for listening.